Okay, we're ready to start our North Canton Bible study here this evening. It also covers the Youngstown Church here in Ohio, as well as the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Wheeling, West Virginia congregations. And some of you who have heard about it and log in and join us, we're always happy to have you with us. It's great to be able to have a Bible study on Friday evening, which we do twice a month. Just as a reminder, the Bible studies are on the Friday evenings before the second and the fourth Sabbaths. So you have to look at the calendar and figure out which the second and fourth Sabbaths, and then log and make a note of the Friday night before that. Okay, this evening we're going to, I think, have a really interesting study. We certainly want God's inspiration upon it, because the person we're studying in Scripture could have used a little bit more of God's inspiration. So if you'll bow your heads, we'll ask God's blessing. Heavenly Father, we just pause before we start our Bible study here to ask your inspiration on the teaching, Father, and the listening, as well as the technology that makes it possible for us to be connected during this time. We thank you for the Sabbath time that is coming to us very shortly as the sun sets here in the east. We know that it already has in the west, or maybe you know it hasn't set in the west. I have that backwards. But whatever the case, Father, you know when the sun sets. We thank you for that. Thank you for the holy time of the Sabbath day. So please inspire our understanding of the scriptures we'll be studying tonight, and we thank you for the blessing of being able to do it. In Jesus Christ's name, amen. Okay, what we'll be covering tonight is a Bible study biography. Now I'm going to quote our person we're going to study here. It comes from Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge to know that God exists of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, God is saying that, and years of life will be added to you if you are wise. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself, and if you scoff, you will bear it alone. So it's better to be wise than it is to be scoffing and not taking God and his way of life seriously. We of all people understand that because God has opened our minds to understand his truth and way of life. So tonight we're going to be looking at the one that God used to write those words in a Bible biography. And from time to time we will do Bible biographies in the Bible, our Friday night Bible studies. Not always, but periodically. Tonight I decided it would be very valuable to simply look at the life of King Solomon. So this is a Bible biography about King Solomon. If you go back, we need to start at the beginning. Usually, we don't look at the background of the person that we're reading quite as much as we should. But with Solomon, we normally stop with Solomon. Well, his father was David. Okay, that's as far as we go. But I would like you to know who his great great grandmother and grandfather were. I think that helps us appreciate the setting of Solomon a little better. David, we know, was the great-grandson of Ruth and Boaz. That makes Solomon the great-great-grandson. Ruth and Boaz. Now, interestingly, we'll touch back on that a little later, too, about Ruth. Ruth was not an Israelite. She was a Moabite. And she had married an Israelite man who had immigrated over to Moab, which was next door to Judea. He died. And his brother died, who was married to a friend of hers. And then the boy's mother, because her husband had died too earlier, decided she must go back to Israel, because she was all that was left of the original Hebrew family that had moved over there. The two daughters didn't want to leave her. They loved her, so they wanted to follow with her. And when Naomi, the mother, admonished them, one went back to her family, but Ruth didn't. She insisted that she believed the truth of the God of Israel. She wanted to live in Israel and worship the true God and to be a daughter-in-law, or more like a daughter by that time, to Naomi. And so she was. And then when she found her husband, a new husband over there, Boaz, you know, then that was going to become the line of David. Well, it's the line of David, it's the line of Solomon, because David was Solomon's father. Let's look now in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, if you want to turn there. 1 Chronicles 3, and we will be kind of moving back and forth between various passages in Chronicles and Kings, but I'll try to give you a few seconds to make those shifts. We'll start in verse 1 of this first section of 1 Chronicles 3. Now these are the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron, or Hebron. The first was Amnon, remember that name, by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. The second son, these are the sons of David, second son of David was Daniel, also called Chileab, and his mother was Abigail, the Carmelitess. You remember the incident with Abigail and David, and then he married her. And the third son was Absalom, another famous son, or shall we say infamous. Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. The fourth son was Adonijah. Remember that name too. Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth was Shephatiah by Abital. I'm guessing on how. For which syllable do you put the emphasis on? I'm guessing on that, but I think that's about right. The sixth son of David, all born in Hebron. David ruled Judah and Benjamin from Hebron, or Hebron, depending on how you like to say it, which is south of Jerusalem about 40 or 50 miles. And he ruled from there for 7 years before they conquered Jerusalem, because he had to conquer Jerusalem from the Jebusites. Then he made it into his capital city. And then over the last decades of his rule, or of the bulk of his time, he was operating out of Jerusalem. Okay, so the sixth son is Ithream, I-T-H-R-E-A-M, by David's wife Eglah. These six were born to him in Hebron, where he reigned 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years. So it was 40 years and 6 months is how long he reigned. And these were born to him in Jerusalem. Now we go through the rest of his children, his sons at least. Shemaiah or Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. Four by Bathsheba. This is from Chronicles. Otherwise, she's known as Bathsheba. The famous one. So she had four sons, and Solomon was one of them. And then, and the daughter, Amiel, also called Eliam, apparently also by Bathsheba. And then there were Ibhar, Elishama, Eliphet, Noga, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama. So we have two Elishamas and two Eliphets and an Eliada. Now, why there were repetitions of the names, I'm not sure. David had many wives. It's possible that the mothers insisted that this is what I wanted to be named, even if somebody else already had the name. That's possible. But these were all the sons of David, it goes on to say, besides the sons of the concubines. So these were the sons of the women who were married as wives. The concubines were what we call sub-wives, apparently. And Tamar, their sister. Tamar is mentioned because Tamar was tragically raped by Amnon, David's oldest son. And then his third oldest son, Absalom, executed Amnon, killed Amnon, and then went on to try to take over the country from David. You remember the story about Absalom. And he was able to pull off a coup d'etat. I failed one because it didn't last very long, thankfully. But that took care of the first two sons and the daughter. Adonijah was the next one. These were of the sons born in Hebron. Adonijah presumptuously tried to take the throne when David was on his deathbed. And that's where we pick up the story in 1 Kings 1. 1 Kings chapter 1. Now stop and think about this. There were 19, according to the count there in Chronicles, 19 sons of David, plus sons of the concubines. David had far less legal claim to the throne, but the 19 sons were significant. There was no prescribed process of succession from the king to his successor. And you think, well, why wasn't there a king before? Well, yes, there was, but what was his name? His name was Saul. Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. David was one of his servants that for part of the time and considered an outlaw the rest of the time, even though he was still working behind the scenes like a Robin Hood trying to defend the country. But there was a change of dynasties. No longer would the king come from Benjamin. The king was going to come out of Judah, and it was going to come through David. David would be the line, ultimately, of the Messiah, of Christ himself, when he was born as a human being. So we come to 1 Kings 1, starting in verse 5. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. So he took the initiative because David was on his deathbed and hadn't transferred authority to his successor, who was going to be Solomon. So Adonijah prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not rebuked him at any time, saying, Why do you do so? That was a problem that David didn't confront him over this. He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. So he was Absalom's brother, full brother to Absalom. Then he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah. Joab was one of David's generals. He was a bloodthirsty general, but he was one. And a capable leader, as far as the leaders went. Zeruiah was his mother, David's sister. What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? When he referred to his cousins. So Joab was a cousin to David. So Adonijah conferred with Joab and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. So one of the leading priests lent the weight of his influence for the kingship of Adonijah. And you know, the reason I'm telling you this in Solomon's biography is to show you the dynamics from which he came. You know, 19 of brothers together. So he had 18 brothers and lots of sisters and lots of then lesser ranking brothers and sisters through, you know, concubines. So in 1 Kings 1:8, but Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, I believe he was one of the mighty men of David, and Nathan the prophet, and Nathan is the one that had to approach David on certain times, Shimei, Rei, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. So these, the prophet Nathan and Benaiah, who was the leader of the mighty men, and Zadok the priest were not with what Adonijah was doing. Then in verse 9, Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fatted cattle by the stone of Zeholeth, which is by Enrogel. And he invited his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah and the king's servants. But, notice in verse 10, he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the mighty man, or Solomon his brother. Now, the comma between is right after Benaiah, he was a mighty man, but then it says the mighty men. So, was it Benaiah the mighty man, or was it Benaiah the leader of the mighty men? And it would appear, as we'll see, it was referring to the mighty men, you know, in addition to Benaiah, even though he was their one of their primary leaders at that time. Since there was no process of already laid down, process of ascension from one regent to another, we had a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum, as we know the old saying, and that's why Adonijah jumped in. Bathsheba and Nathan, the prophet, informed David of Adonijah's presumption, however. They told him what was happening. David was on his deathbed. He was not well. He was dying. So David rallies from his bed, and he issues the order of Solomon's ascension to the throne. Notice in verse 32 of 1 Kings chapter 1, and the king said, call to me Zadok the priest, and Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. And they came before the king, and the king said to them, take with you the servants of your lord, and have Solomon, my son, ride my own mule and take him down to Gihon. That's a spring in the lower part of Jerusalem. I've been mulling over why would it be chosen as the site for anointing him as king. One thing it would provide an amphitheater for many people to see what was happening based on the lay of the land around it. So perhaps that was the reason. It doesn't specifically say. But it was going to be down at the spring Gihon. And there Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet, and anoint him king over Israel. Blow the horn and say, long live King Solomon. Then you shall come up after him, and he shall come up and sit on my throne, and he shall be king in my place, where I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and Judah. So David, when he realized the crisis was at its critical point, he rallied all of his later, you know, the last energy he had to get up and make these orders and effect the succession to Solomon. In verse 38 of 1 Kings 1, so Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Chelethites and the Pelethites. Now, Chelethites and the Pelethites were two of the groupings of the mighty men. And it's very interesting when you go back and read this, and I was surprised when I did some research on a previous sermon a year or two ago, I was surprised to find out that the Chelethites and the Pelethites were made up of Cretans from the island of Crete and Philistines. And based on other research, the Philistines and the Cretans were related to each other. David's arch enemies in his early days were the Philistines. It was Goliath that David killed to deliver Israel at a critical time. And yet his enemies respected him to where his most loyal bodyguard, and this was a few hundred men, it wasn't just a handful, it was a few hundred men, were actually not Israelites at all, or maybe some Israelites mixed with them, but they were primarily Philistines. But they respected David as their leader, which that's kind of a testament to his leadership. So they went down and had Solomon ride on David's mule, or could be a mule or could be a horse. There would be a royal mount, and it would have had the trappings of being the royal horse that the king rode, and now the new king is going to be riding it. Took him to Gihon. Zadok the priest took a horn of oil from the tabernacle. He anointed Solomon. They blew the horn, and all the people said, long live Solomon, and all the people went up after him, and they played the flutes, and they rejoiced with great joy, so that the earth seemed to split with their sound. Now, that was not good news for Adonijah or anybody who supported him in his attempt to be made king, because not only did the current king David disapprove of it, and all of the ones who were surrounding Solomon and the bodyguard of David, who were, you know, the fiercest warriors in the land, or among the fiercest, but the people were absolutely ecstatic that Solomon was going to be king. So David gave Solomon's instructions how to deal with the interlopers, which he did over a period of time. Some happened right away, others took a little longer. And Solomon carried out the orders of execution, and for some it was forced retirement. For instance, the priest that had backed Adonijah was told, you can go back to your lands that weren't anywhere near Jerusalem, and you stay there. Don't ever come back to Jerusalem. And a few other issues had to be made. Now that gives us the setting. Solomon is now king. There was the drama that unfolded there. But I think it helps us to understand and appreciate the dynamics of Solomon, and perhaps a recognition that he needed greater wisdom in dealing with all of this political mishmash that he had to run into, and dealing with things in general, and the greatness of what he had been called to do, to be the king of God's nation, Israel. Not just any nation, but God's nation, the one he had picked to be the model nation, if only they would obey, the model nation so the other nations could learn from them. In chapter 3 of 1 Kings, chapter 3 and verse 1. Now Solomon made a treaty with the Pharaoh king of Egypt, married Pharaoh's daughter, and he brought her to the city of David until he finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall all around Jerusalem. And meanwhile, the people sacrificed in high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord in those days. Excuse me. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense in high places. Solomon was dedicated. He actively followed God, but he hung back to the pagan tendencies of sacrificing in high places. High places were where sacrifices were made to various pagan gods. Even if you sacrifice to God on the high places that weren't sanctioned, it gave the illusion, at the very least, of worshiping the pagans. Now, one of the wise things, perhaps, that he did, he made a peace treaty with Egypt. That's why he had Pharaoh's daughter. that's how peace treaties were typically formalized in the ancient world in many, many cases, that one king married the other king's daughter so that they would now be technically related. And that's a practice that is not limited to just in the biblical times. It extended all the way up into the Viking era. Something very similar. Eventually, sometimes it wasn't a marriage, although marriage was always a part of it. Other times, you took the child of one whom with you made a treaty, and that became your foster son. But he had to live where you were, in your capital city, to make sure that his father didn't break the treaty. And the father would have the other guy, the man would have one of this king's children with him as a foster child, again, as an insurance policy to keep the treaty active. And these kinds of marriages were the way the world did that in those days. But what it did affect is he had peace with Egypt. So Egypt wasn't attacking. And as things develop, you will find that he also had peace in the north with Phoenicia. Phoenicia is where the area of Tyre and Sidon. So the Tyrrhenians are Tyrians. I think that's how it would be said. And the Sidonians were at peace with him. They were the Phoenicians. And we'll see why that was important as well in just a little bit as we go through this. But he had good connections in both directions. Now, he had peace on his borders, except for the eastern border out toward what would be today Iraq and Iran, that direction. Now, that will be covered here in a minute. Then God gives, at this time, Solomon a choice. I'll give you whatever you want. And Solomon said, I want wisdom. And so this is in chapter 3, verse 7. Of 1 Kings. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to come, go out or come in. And David would have been in his very early 20s, in his beginning years as a king. Your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant, and he didn't ask for lots of money. He didn't ask for, I don't know what else you would ask for. Pleasure cruise ships or something, maybe. He didn't ask for that. Give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people. Enable me to serve by making me wise. Very laudable. And to a large extent, was used correctly. Now, we'll get into when it wasn't. We've already touched on it a little bit. That I may discern between good and evil. For who was able to judge this great people of yours? Well, it pleased God that he asked for that. He gave him that great wisdom, which is why Solomon is famous. He was very wise. We even have the same today when referring to someone as wise as Solomon. Or what do you think you are, wise as Solomon? Why? Because Solomon is personified as being the epitome of wisdom in human history. So the challenge and the proof of the wisdom came right away. And you know this story. It's the same chapter there, 1 Kings chapter 3. I won't read it all, but I'll summarize it. There were two harlots. And, of course, they had each had a baby. They were living in the same room, a tiny apartment of some kind. And one lay on her son in the night, leaned over, rolled over, and laid on him, and he died. Tragic, tragic. Imagine her grief when all this was done. But she was a hard dealer. She got up in the night and she took her dead son and put him beside her. So, the one she called her friend, at least they were roommates, put that on her bed beside her, and she took the live son back to her bed. And so Solomon then had to make the decision. And he had to decide which baby belonged to which woman. And they both testified, the live one is mine, the dead one is hers. And the dead one was a good liar. The mother of the dead baby was actually a very good liar. So it was hard to tell. So Solomon said, all right, bring a child here and we'll divide him in half. And he called one of his bodyguards to do that. And immediately the true mother said, don't kill it. She can have it. Don't kill it. And Solomon said, okay, you're the true mother, you get the baby. And that, the the wisdom there was remarkable. He had a profound understanding of human nature. I don't mean the carnal human nature only. You have to understand that too. But he understood the nature that God made man with, that there is this love of a mother for her children, a love of a father for his children too, the romantic love between a man and a woman that would cause them to want to be married to each other and to build a family. And he understood those basic drives that God put in, which it seems in our day nobody understands things like that much at all. But Solomon did. And the people could see that was a very wise move, and so he became very famous for that. Wisdom that God had given him. Now, let's look at a resume of expertise, because with his wisdom came a phenomenal intellect. There are all kinds of wisdoms. There's spiritual wisdom, which is what we always strive to do to develop and study in God's Word and the way we live our lives. But there are other wisdoms in a sense too. We might call them fields of study or bodies of knowledge. Architecture, for example, or building a building. You know, there's a whole another branch of knowledge and applied mathematics and that sort of thing that comes, and physics that comes in building buildings. Solomon understood all that. So did David, by the way, because Solomon built the temple in 7 years. That's covered in 1 Kings 5 and 6. He gave the temple the prayer of and speech of dedication. And God sent his divine presence into the temple. The Jews refer to that divine presence as the Shekinah. Filled the temple with clouds so thick that the priests who were fulfilling certain of the ceremonies in the temple had to come back outside because they couldn't see. And that's another study, maybe for another time. But Solomon didn't design this building. He designed others. And you can see why. David designed the temple. That's 1 Chronicles 22 gives you that story. David designed it. He designed it. He planned for it. He analyzed what it should be like. He drew up the plan, so to speak. And then he set about collecting the building materials. So he had amassed many of the building materials, not all, but many of them, that Solomon was going to need. So Solomon was a builder like his father. He went on to build palaces, cities, so he was an urban planner. All sorts of other structures that were supervised by Solomon and more than likely designed by Solomon. He was an empire builder as well. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 4. Here it says in verse 20 to 25, Judah and Israel were so numerous as the sand of the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river. The river referred to here is the Euphrates River. Well, when you look at your map in the back of your Bible, you'll see that the only river that exists in Israel is the Jordan River. I mean, the only major river that runs kind of north and south. There are a few smaller rivers that run down into the Mediterranean Sea, out of the mountain, the coastal mountain range. But the only one that goes through a great portion of the country is the Jordan. It's not a seafaring river. I mean, it doesn't link to the sea, it links to the Dead Sea, but the Dead Sea doesn't go anywhere because you have to climb 1,300 feet in elevation to get to the Red Sea, which is about 70 miles south of the south end of the Dead Sea. You go up out of a deep hole. It is the lowest part, lowest piece of land on the surface of the planet, below sea level, on the dry surface. And there are deeper places underwater, but no, not any on land. So when it says the river, it has to be the river that was called the river by everybody else. That's the Euphrates. That meant that the land of Israel in Solomon's time stretched all the way out across what is today desert, because it hasn't been managed for centuries very well, all the way out to the Euphrates River. And Tadmor was one of the cities that he owned. It was out on that, one of the major traveling routes that came across to the coastland. So the Israelites were numerous. They brought tribute to Solomon. He reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. Israel's right in between there. And as far as the border of Egypt, all the way down to Egypt. So he expanded his territory of Israel dramatically. I mean, he had the main body of the nation, and then you had the auxiliary territories that were under his guidance and governance. He had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tisha, even to Gaza. Gaza is where Gaza was, on the coast, down the southern coast of Israel today. Namely, over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side around him. So Solomon was a diplomat of considerable capability, a very wise diplomat. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, in verse 25, each man under his own vine and fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. And it was 40 years of peace and prosperity. In 2 Chronicles chapter 8, we also have a little bit of an added comment on this. 2 Chronicles 8, verses 1 to 4. It came to pass at the end of 20 years that Solomon had built the house of the Lord and his own house, that the cities which Hiram had given to Solomon, Hiram was the king of Phoenicia or of Tyre, king of Tyre, Solomon built them, and he settled the children of Israel there, and Solomon went to Hamath Zobah and seized it, and he also built Tadmor in the wilderness, and the storage cities which he had built in Hamath. So that would be way out into what is today the desert of Syria and Iraq. That's where Solomon's territory border was. And as I said, I doubt that it was the sand-driven territory that it is largely today. It wasn't that deep desert because it was managed better. Solomon built empire power. In 1 Kings 4, back there again, comments about what he had developed. He had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots. Now, it doesn't say how many horses were in each stall. It may have been more than one. 12,000 horsemen, now presumably therefore is cavalry mounted on horses rather than following them in a chariot. All these, and these governors, each man in his month provided food for King Solomon and all who came to Solomon's table, and there was no lack in their supply because he had divided up his territory. He was a remarkable an organizer as King David had been, and he organized the territories into three great districts, or the Israelites, and then the other districts for the international areas, and they all, you know, paid their part of their taxes were to be sent in and foodstuffs and other things that were needed at the palace and other places, as well as provision for the horses needed for the cavalry and for the chariot cavalry. He built wealth into his empire. This is 1 Kings 10. You know, when you look at this, it's a lot to grasp looking at what Solomon was able to do, but it's good to have an overview, a sense of the biography and the life of the individuals we read about in Scripture. It helps you appreciate them more, understand them more, recognize them as just regular folks like us, except a whole lot smarter, in Solomon's case, a whole lot smarter. Not necessarily spiritually wiser at a certain point in his life, but a whole lot smarter intellect-wise. But in verse 14 and 15, the weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. And besides that, from traveling merchants and income from traders and from all the kings of Arabia and all the governors of the country. See, his influence extended way down into Arabia. And we might think today, wow, yeah, that's a lot of sand. It wasn't sand then. And there were rich kingdoms down there at that time. And the climate wasn't the same as it is today. Still, it was arid, or perhaps semi-arid, but it wasn't, you know, a desert, like the Arabian desert, like it is today. So that meant something. That was a territory that produced a lot of food. Just like we talk about deserts, when you go over North Africa, you come to, trying to think of the name of the country, it's directly south of Italy a little ways, but whatever the case, that is pretty much desert now. I don't know if that's Tunisia, it may be Tunisia on our maps today. But in the days of the Romans, that was Kansas. That's where they grew their grain. They couldn't grow enough grain for the Roman people in Italy. They grew other things, but they couldn't grow grain in quantities big enough to supply for everybody. So they conquered part of North Africa, and that became their granary. It isn't a granary today. The Sahara Desert has moved in because of the wars over the centuries, and then some peoples just don't have a knack for farming and land management. And so the climate changes, and it did. It was a drastic climate change. In Solomon's day, a lot of what we consider to be sand in parts of Iraq and down in Arabia, where either his boundary or his influence was, were actually much more prosperous countries at that time. Verse 21, King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon, that would have been his palace, were pure gold. And no, not one was silver, for this accounted as nothing in Solomon's day. Silver was like stones. And the king had merchant ships at sea and a fleet with the fleet of Hiram. And once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. The words for apes and monkeys is not clear. I think the King James called one of them peacocks because it was a little unclear as to exactly what it was. The translation, that is. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. 3 year voyages. Not the 5 year voyage of the Star Trek Enterprise, or Starship Enterprise, but the 3 year voyages of the fleets of Solomon and Hiram. They had two fleets. One were the ships of Tarsus, which was a deep sea vessel, and I'm amazed at how many biblical historians don't know that Tarsus is in Spain. I just read of one the other day that had no idea where Tarsus was. It's in Spain. Why is it in Spain? Because that's the gateway to the deep Atlantic. So Phoenicians were in the Mediterranean. They sailed back and forth through there. Circumnavigation is what you can do in 3 years. This is talking, far more likely is this talking about circumnavigation of the planet, going all the way around the earth in a sailboat. That's how long it takes. Magellan's crew found that out centuries and centuries and centuries later. But the fleets of the Phoenicians had known it for a long time. So did the Israelites. Then there was a second fleet. If you go down to the southern end of Israel today, you have a town called Eilat, right on the Red Sea, that eastern branch of the Red Sea that goes up there. Eilat is right, there's a town next door to it in Jordan, because that's where they border. Well, that was Ezion Geber in those days, and Hiram sent some of his sailing men and shipbuilders down to assist the Israelites in establishing a fleet out of that end of Israel, as well as off the northern end of Israel. So they had a worldwide presence, Solomon's empire did. Remarkable time that it was. And in verse 24, now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. So kings, just like the Queen of Sheba, came up from Arabia or Africa, down in the territory where Yemen, the little bulge of Yemen, sticks out in Saudi Arabia. She came up from down there someplace, the Queen of Sheba did, to find out how wise this Solomon fellow was. Found out he was very wise. She brought him very expensive gifts, but she did all right because he sent her home with gifts that were far more valuable than the ones she had brought. So they wanted to hear his wisdom. And you have to stop and think, when would be the time that kings and queens and such would want to be in Israel to see the full greatness of Solomon's wisdom? And I would think it would be during the Holy Day time, probably around the Feast of Tabernacles, the greatest festival, when the crowds in Jerusalem would be huge, when the people would be amassed, where you could see them, where you would see the pomp and the ceremony and of the temple services and the ceremonies that had to do with the king. And then you would have heard of the feast days of God. That was a powerful witness, I'm sure, to some in those days that we'll harvest in the White Throne Judgment. Verse 26, Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He loved horses. He had lots of them. In 27, silver was as common in Jerusalem as stones. Gold was what you dealt with. Silver, well, you made stuff out of it, but it wasn't worth anywhere near what the gold was. He had horses imported from Egypt, and the king's servants bought them in Keva at a current price, and chariots were imported from Egypt, and their cost was such and such, 600 shekels of silver here, and a horse was 150. Thus, through their agents, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. In other words, they imported them from Israel and exported them north to Syria and Phoenicia, or not Phoenicia, but Syria and to the Hittites, which were the Hittites, very likely a branch of the Assyrians, and they were further north into what we know as Asia Minor today. So the nation of Israel did business in horses and chariots. His wisdom was remarkable in 1 Kings 4, 29 to 32. God gave Solomon wisdom and exceeding great understanding, 1 Kings 4, verses 29 to 32, and largeness of heart. And I think that would translate today in a huge intellect. You know, people would consider the heart, refer to something as having great heart, if they had a broad scope or vision of things. In our modern times, we tend to think brain rather than heart. Like the sand on the seashore it was. So Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and the wisdom of Egypt. And there were wise men in many countries, but his was wiser. He was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, than Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And some of them were musicians in Israel that were brilliant and wise and smart and capable, phenomenal musicians in the choirs and orchestras of David that he had organized. And yet Solomon was wiser than they were. It's entirely possible, and I've looked through this and done a study on it in the past, that if they were in fact, as it appears, as it implies, a part of the musical substructure of David's government, then there's something about the rhythm and the movement of music that helps us think in balanced lines and in wise lines to come to understand things. It fits into being an intellect builder in that sense. So Solomon's fame was all over the world at that time. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and we don't have 3,000 proverbs in the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes combined. We have the pick, I would say, of them, because God inspired those to be included. And his songs were 1,005. Now, in the book of Psalms, there are at least two psalms that are attributed directly to Solomon. David had the majority of them there, but it's, you can see where, like father, like son, David was very wise himself. Solomon was much larger intellect, apparently, even than his father. But David was a tremendous psalmist. In fact, when he died, his epitaph was that he was the sweet psalmist of Israel. Now, a psalmist was not just, a good songwriter. I got tears in my ears from lying on my back in my bed crying over you type songs. It wasn't that at all. These were psalms or songs. A psalm is a song. Normally glorifying God and extolling the beauty of his creation, that kind of thing. And it required a significant intellect to write those things. You had to have the knowledge to be able to turn it into a song. Solomon wrote several of the psalms in Scripture, therefore. He wrote the book of Proverbs, and when I say wrote, he compiled it, because some of the Proverbs we would see as his, and sometimes we aren't 100% sure, but we analyzed and think that certain ones would be. And others were collections of Proverbs that he gathered from others. See, the really wise man looks for the wisdom that is already available and brings it together. Solomon certainly did that. So you will find different collections of Psalm 30 has two or three that are mentioned, and in various other places you'll have a mention of somebody famous that in that time, that we don't know now, who had written certain proverbs. So he wrote, he is responsible for the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. Biblical historians would also put in perhaps the book of Job. There are a number of them that will comment on that. Not that he wrote Job, but that he recognized the inspiration of the book of Job and put it into the collection of books that would become the Old Testament. Now, God would have guided that process very carefully, of course. But Job is another great wisdom book, a phenomenal book. We'll have to do a biography on Job sometime. He wrote the Song of Solomon as well, Ecclesiastes. We're going to end with Ecclesiastes here in a few minutes. Let's consider some of his phenomenal intellect, however. Going on to just a couple of other things. In 1 Kings 4, verses 33 to 34, we're back in 1 Kings 4 again. And he spoke of trees. Did you speak of trees today? I did. I spoke of two different kinds of maple trees. And I was quite impressed that I knew two different kinds of maple trees. I looked at trees, and I knew some of their names. The type of tree they were. When it says that Solomon spoke of trees, that meant that he knew prodigious amounts of information about each species. That Solomon was a phenomenal naturalist. He understood, or a forester, silviculturist is another term for that. He understood trees. He spoke of trees, because those are the big plants, from the cedar trees of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows out of the, springs out of the wall. Now, the hyssop is a tiny little plant. So he's not just talking trees, we're talking botany, the study of big plants, trees, down to the study of tiny plants like the hyssop. Solomon knew all of that. Most of our scientists today, they focus on one narrow branch, and they don't consider the holistic pattern and the vast amount of knowledge that covers the type of organism that they're studying. Very few really get into that. But those that do, frankly, I think have a better understanding, because you have to have to see how things fit together. So he understood plants from the cedars of Lebanon right down to the little hyssop in the, that springs out between the rocks and a rock wall. He spoke also of animals. And when it says he spoke of animals, you could say, well, I spoke of animals today. I spoke about chipmunks in our backyard. And the cats got very excited. So I spoke about cats, too. Except we didn't see any, so then they weren't so excited. He spoke of animals. That meant that he understood animals. He studied them. He was an inveterate naturalist in studying animals. And he was an ornithologist. He spoke of birds. And you think, what do you mean? He's a king. He's a politician, you know, but not quite in the sense we are today, yet some ways it's so similar. Why would he know about birds? Do you know who the president of the Ornithological Society was in the first decade of the 20th century? I don't hear any takers. Okay, I'll tell you. The president of the United States was. Theodore Roosevelt knew more about birds than anybody else in America and most of the world at the time. I mean, that was only one of his areas of expertise. So Solomon spoke of birds. Now we understand, oh yeah, people could speak of birds. And creeping things, bugs, worms, snakes, all those things. He was a herpetologist, that's snake studier, and I don't know what a bugologist is called for sure, but he did that. He also spoke about fish. He knew fish. Well, that meant that he went fishing? Oh yeah, I'm sure he did. Spearfishing probably, when he felt energetic, line fishing, I'm sure they had, line fishing is as ancient as man is. Net fishing, I'm sure that Solomon understood all of that. But he understood the fish that they were catching, and he could tell people about them. That's a prodigious intellect that studies things, is interested in them, and rapidly gathers the knowledge, either from other experts in the field or from books, if the books were written about them. And the men of all nations and all kings of the earth had heard of his wisdom. They came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. He understood so many things, such a multifaceted man. And we think, well, yeah, but you know, we have scientists today that would know more. I doubt it. I doubt that they would. They certainly don't understand. They don't know who made these things, these organisms, because the theory of evolution is their doctrine. Their wisdom is small compared to Solomon's. And again, to think that, well, great men wouldn't be bothered by these things. Well, it bothered George Washington, didn't it? He knew a great deal about the natural world, George Washington did. Our second or third president, Thomas Jefferson, knew phenomenal amounts about all kinds of things, and including plants and animals, that he studied those things. So we see we do have a precedent, even in the modern era, for some regents to be a little bit like Solomon. They weren't anywhere near to the magnitude of Solomon, but they were a little bit about like that. Okay, now we finally come down to the troubles. We looked at all the good things of Solomon's life in this biography, and so we're going to come to the troubles. I'm going to skim through this. It's mostly summarized in 1 Kings 11. First 8 verses, or, well, a little more than 8 verses, 13, 14 verses. Verse 1 has an ominous ring, but King Solomon loved many foreign women. And it lists a bunch of places where they come. Even though God had said, a little further down, you shall not intermarry with them, nor away with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts from their gods, after their gods. And Solomon clung to these in love, And when he was old, in verse 4, his wives turned his heart to other gods. And it was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. So he went after the Ashtaroth. The Ashtaroth is the word for Easter. That's where Easter comes from, is Ashtaroth. It was a goddess, the goddess of the Sidonians. It was there was a counterpart goddess in virtually any culture that would amount to being the same one. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, did not fully follow the Lord as did his father, and he built a high place for Shemesh, one of the gods of the Sidonians, or not the Sidonians, Moabites, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem. That would have probably been Mount of Olives, or, well, that is the hill that's directly east of Jerusalem. That was not a good thing. So he sacrificed to the gods that his foreign wives worshipped. Well, this began to erode his wisdom. God became angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away. And he said down in verse 11, surely I will tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. And he did. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, of the tribe of Ephraim, got 10 tribes. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, ended up with only 2 tribes. Well, technically 3 when you throw in the Levites. But otherwise it was Judah, Benjamin, and then Levi. Now, we got to bring this to an end. So how do you analyze Solomon's life? Did he ever learn anything? We don't have his statements on his deathbed. We just know that he died. Or do we? The book of Ecclesiastes, many people don't understand. That's a pity because it's a fascinating book. And we'll do Bible study. We'll probably do 2 or 3 on that one. But let's go to chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes. Here is a testament to Solomon's wisdom. Because even when he was doing the wrong things, God allowed him to maintain great wisdom. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come. What are the difficult days? How old are you? When you reach a certain age in life, you know, in your late 50s, maybe your 60s, or for some of you, you might be 80 before you start feeling the pains and aches of age. But you know that your youth is gone, and now you're an older person. And pretty soon you drop the ER off of older. Now you're an old person, and you know it. Those are the difficult days, and there are a lot of aches and pains, and where it's hard to see. And that's what the rest of this imagery is all about. We'll save that for another time in detail. So what about that? What about to remember your Creator in the days of your youth? Go back to verse 6, or on down to verse 6. Remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed and the golden bowl is broken. So you have a silver cord. Remember, silver was like stones in Israel. So you can make cord, you can make wire out of it. So it's a cord. And you've got a golden bowl. And it's being held up by the silver wire. And somehow the silver wire breaks and it drops the bowl to the ground. And the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the well. You know, life ends just like that at a certain point. And dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return, that is, the spirit in man returns to the God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. When you say vanity, we don't mean arrogance in the specific sense. We mean grasping for the wind. It's like a vapor. Have you ever caught any fog in your hand? Did you go out on a foggy morning and think, whoa, this fog is so thick, and you try to bring some inside in your hand, and you get inside and you don't have it anymore? Well, that's what trying to catch a vapor. All things our vanity or our vapor, dust on the wind, so to speak. Moreover, though, now we come down to the last part, and this is what gives me hope in thinking about Solomon. And moreover, verse 9, because the preacher was wise, the preacher is the Koholeth, the caller of assemblies, and Solomon in his day was the caller of assemblies. He was the king. People assembled when he said, for, you know, various things, and then he called the assemblies of God. And the assemblies of the holy days and the Sabbath day and so on. He still taught the people knowledge, even though he had made some mistakes. Yes, he pondered and set out and set in order many proverbs. And some of them are proverbs of experience, too. The preacher sought to find acceptable words. What was written was upright, words of truth. He analyzed these things. This is the work of Solomon, God working through Solomon. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And you think, well, what's a goad? You stopped right there when I said that, didn't you? Goad is a sharp-pointed stick you use to drive oxen. You know, if they get pokey and you need them to go a little faster, you just poke them gently. I mean, it's not sharp-sharp, but it's, you know, it comes to a slight point, or slightly rounded. And that motivates them to move forward at a quicker pace. You're not trying to hurt them. You're just trying to move them a little quicker. It's like an accelerator pedal, gas pedal. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails. And you remember the term where we say somebody says something that is exactly the right thing, and you turn to them and you say, wow, you really nailed it, didn't you? I mean, that's exactly the right thing. Well, this is the concept here. Well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of the making of books there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. So let's hear the conclusion to the whole matter. And I think this is the conclusion to the matter of Solomon's life. Not everybody agrees with that, but it certainly seems to be here in the scripture. His last book, Solomon wrote the Song of Solomon when he was younger. That's the way commentators have analyzed that for centuries. He wrote the book of Proverbs in his middle years and in his late years when he was feeling his age gathering to him quickly. He wrote Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is brilliant wisdom, and as a book, fascinating study. But here's the conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments. That's what you do. You fear God and keep his commandments. Well, I don't want to be afraid of God. Come on. When it says fear God in the Bible, it doesn't mean to be terror-stricken by God. It is to be humbled in his presence. It is to honor him. And frankly, it means to love him. Fear him in that sense. It's a deep, deep devotion to God. And you don't want to do what he doesn't want you to do. Now, we should understand that because we have God's Spirit to help us overcome the short thinking of our carnal human nature. Fear God and keep his commandments. Well, I don't want to be told what to do. Well, do you want to be in God's kingdom? You're going to be told what to do. Keep his commandments. For this is man's all. That's why we're here. To learn to be like God is. And how do we do that? We keep his commandments. Because that defines the character of God. It defines, therefore, the character we want to have. That we want to assimilate. And God wants us to assimilate. For God will bring every work into judgment. He did in Solomon's case. He brought it into judgment. And he didn't leave a great empire to Rehoboam. He left a much, much smaller one by his own mistakes. God will bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or evil. So man's all is to keep fear God and keep his commandments. And I think those are fitting words to conclude a fairly quick overview of the life of Solomon here. And I think this is a valuable biography for you. I encourage you to read the book of the biography of Solomon for yourself. Go back to those chapters we covered. There are a few others you'll find in Chronicles that we didn't go through, but they're parallel accounts in Kings and Chronicles. And then look at the Proverbs. Read that introduction to the Proverb, you know, Proverbs, and you're like, oh, that's Solomon writing. Yes. Then read Ecclesiastes. Again, we'll do a Bible study on Ecclesiastes so you can appreciate it even more. And sometime even one on the Song of Solomon, which was another of his writings. Multifaceted in every way. So we want to thank you tonight. We did get a Bible study question, but as I glance at it, I'm thinking I'm going to need to answer it in this next Bible study, which is in 2 weeks. So please be sure to be connecting with us at 7:30 on that evening in 2 weeks. It'll be the Friday night before the fourth Sabbath of this month. And I want to thank you for this. Have a pleasant Sabbath. For those of you in our congregations, we'll see you tomorrow in North Canton and Youngstown.